In Fair, Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 154, William Chamberlain's LDS Idea of God, a paper presented by James McLaughlin, with a response by L. Rex Sears.
I'm Nicholson, and this is Session number 154, William Chamberlain's LDS Idea of God, and the ongoing McLaughlin series on William Chamberlain. I think this is the fourth or fifth presentation, but they all have different points of emphasis, and it's a very rich philosophy, Chamberlain's personalism, as you'll find in the course of this session. So there's going to, won't be much repetition, I hope. My name is John Nicholson. I'm the moderator. I do have a master's degree in philosophy, but since I'm just a chair, you don't see it on there. You know, I just got it, and I was eager to see it on the program, and it's not on there. But I do have training in philosophy, hence some reason for me to be the moderator here. The presenter is Mr. James McLaughlin, a man I've known for more than a few years now. He has his undergraduate degree from Brigham Young is in history and philosophy. He has an MA from Indiana University in History and his PhD from the University of Toronto in Religious Studies. He's employed as a full professor of philosophy and religion at Western Carolina University. He has several publications on process, philosophy, and theology, and a book he's written on called Desire to be God, Freedom and the Other in Sartre and Berdyaev. After he gives his presentation, we'll hear from Mr. L. Rex Sears. Didn't know you had a first initial L, since I was Rex, who has an extensive education in law and philosophy, a BS and MS from the University of Utah. In philosophy, an AM and PhD degree in philosophy from Harvard University, and last but not least, a Juris Doctorate from the University of Chicago. He's the president and employee as an attorney in Salt Lake City. He has many publications, articles and dialogues, Sunstone of the Utah Law Review, and is currently practicing law. And says here he's a proponent of unpopular views on what free will means. I don't know if we get a chance to get into that, but I know we all like hear unpopular views here at Sunstone. And without further ado, I'll turn the time over to Mr. McLaughlin.
I don't know if you can see it over here, but there's a 4-foot-long skateboard. Rex skateboarded down here from his office, and I'm impressed that somebody that skateboards is this spiffy a dresser. So, but hey, it's pretty cool. Has anybody, how many of you have actually ever heard of William Chamberlain before? Good, good. Hey, how many of you had to sit through one of my papers before? Notice not too many of those. Okay, I'm going to say a little bit about Chamberlain's history and then launch into his idea of God. Chamberlain was born around 1870, served a mission in the Society Islands in 1895, where he translated the Book of Mormon and Doctrine and Covenants into Tahitian. Taught at mathematics at LDS College, and then got another job at Brigham Young College in Logan, Utah. You know, if you know anything about the college system back then, these were more like high schools than colleges, but he was teaching up there. He's teaching mathematics and astronomy, and they let him go for a week, for a summer, and he went to, they gave him some time off. He went to University of Chicago, where he was supposed to take math classes. He didn't. He took classes in Hebrew and Hebrew Bible and philosophy. And I've read his mission journals, too. He's reading philosophy on his mission. Every day he got up and read the Book of Mormon and John Dewey, which is quite a combination. But anyway, he went back and he taught math again. And they let him go another summer. He actually for a couple of semesters back at the University of Chicago. And he once again didn't do what he was supposed to and sat in and took philosophy classes and religion classes. And finally they figured out, well, we'll just make him a professor of theology at BY College. Then he took a year off and went out to the University of California at Berkeley and studied with a guy named George Holmes Howison, who at the time was one of the most famous philosophers in the country. And there he did his master's degree, wrote his master's thesis, The Unity of Thought is the Society of Minds. And if you read this, it's kind of hard to find, but hopefully one of these days when I get this anthology of Chamberlain's work published, you can read it, but it's a very Mormon piece. Went back to BY College, and then took off to Harvard to study with Howison's rival. I'll talk a little bit about this. The most famous American idealist probably ever, Josiah Royce. Stayed there for a year. And what's amazing about Chamberlain is he never had any money. So he was, you know, he's always doing these things pretty much on the fly, and he had about four or five kids, too. He was a Mormon. But then he came home and in 1909 got a job at BYU. That didn't work out because at that point, you know, the reason most people remember Chamberlain is because he was involved in the modernism controversy at BYU over evolution and higher criticism of the scripture, along with his brother Ralph and the Peterson brothers. I've written about that elsewhere, and Richard Sherlock and others, and I'm not going to really talk about that today. But his brother Ralph and the Peterson brothers both left in 1911. He stayed on for 5 years. He was incredibly strongly committed to the church. He stayed on until 1916, and then they started dropping his classes from the class schedule, even though they were full. And he resigned, but it was really he resigned under pressure. In 1916, then, he went back to Harvard to finish his PhD, but Royce had died, and he studied there with another famous American philosopher, which was a bad choice on his part, a guy named Ralph Barton Perry. Now, there was another famous American philosopher there who was picked up Royce's idealism, a guy named William Ernst Haakon. And if you were at the process philosophy meeting a little earlier this morning, Haakon was the guy who invited Alfred North Whitehead to come to Harvard in the 1920s. Chamberlain studied with Haakon, he probably would have completed his dissertation, but he studied with Ralph Barton Perry, who was absolutely antagonistic to idealism in all its forms, and Chamberlain thought this would be a challenge. You know, and for those of you who've done graduate work, don't try challenges, okay? You know, because you live and die by these guys that control your life for a few years. But anyway, he didn't finish. He came, but at Harvard, he was told that you know, when he ran out of money again, that they could get him a job anywhere. You know, having an MA and as much education as he had, he would have been able to find a job anywhere. But he said, if I can't teach in Utah, I don't want to teach anywhere. These are my people. So he went back to Utah, couldn't get a job, taught part-time at UVU, taught extension, and there's where he taught D.E. Erickson, who later became professor of philosophy at the University of Utah. They named a chair after him, the E. Erickson chair that was held by Sterling McMurrin. He was the president of the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association, and in his memoirs talks about Chamberlain as being his philosophical, even though he didn't become an idealist, but as being his philosophical inspiration, the guy that got him into it. In 1920, he went back to BY College in Logan, and if you know U.S. history, he got the flu that year. And like so many other people, he died. On his deathbed, he was offered a job teaching summer school at BYU and said, well, this is a little late, and so didn't go, and just said goodbye to his children. 5 years later, 4 years later, his brother Ralph Chamberlain wrote a book that you can still get if you go down to Sam Weller's, called The Life and Philosophy of William H. Chamberlain. There was actually a William H. Chamberlain Society for a while, and at this time, things had kind of changed in the church education system, and the then commissioner of church education made it required reading for every church educator. Was published by Deseret News Press, And I have a letter from David O. McKay to Ralph Chamberlain apologizing for what happened to William. It's a really wonderful letter where he says it was a true tragedy that something like this should have happened to somebody like William Chamberlain. Anyway, for years, Chamberlain was included in lists of important Mormon intellectuals. If you read that one, Leonard Arrington did in Dialogue back in the 60s, Chamberlain is there. But by the time it gets redone in the late 70s, early 80s, he's fallen off the radar screen. Sterling McMurrin, in Matters of Conscience, that book that he did, says that he considered William Chamberlain the greatest Mormon metaphysician. Better than Orson Pratt, better than Parley Pratt, then that it was a pity that Chamberlain didn't really get to work out his entire system. He planned to write a book on Mormon theology, which included the Pratts and William Chamberlain. But now, you know, today, you know, except for a few people, hardly anybody's heard of William H. Chamberlain. That's because he never really published anything in his life, except for little booklets that he did for his classes. I'm trying to put those booklets together along with a few other essays. I just found another one at the Church Elias Church Archives in the Joseph F. Smith collection and put it out as a book. And these kind of papers have developed in relation to that effort. Chamberlain fits into a larger kind of U.S. intellectual and religious history at the end of the 19th and early 20th century in what's called the modernism controversy. And this doesn't just happen at BYU. I mean, I think in Utah it's even more so than in other places, because in Utah we've just become a state. We've just given up polygamy. We've just given up the political kingdom. And so this transition is really jarring in Utah. And you read Chamberlain's diaries from when he was a little boy. He talks about, you know, his concerns about that Zion is moving from, you know, the more communitarian Zion to a more cutthroat capitalist Zion. And that carries on through his writings all the way through, because what he comes up with is generally a social idea of God. But like I say, this controversy is going on everywhere. Part of the controversy about evolution is not just about the science. You remember William Jennings Bryan, you know, the monkey trial. But if you go back to 1905, you know, one of the things that they're terribly concerned with isn't about the science of evolution. It's about the social implications of social Darwinism. And philosophers who are really popular, though not very good, like Herbert Spencer, who advocate a type of egoism, survival of the fittest. And if you remember back, if you've read about William Jennings Bryan, one of the things, he's a social reformer, albeit a kind of Christian conservative. But he gave the famous "Don't crucify man upon a cross of gold" speech. And one of the things he's concerned about is that this new scientific theory has been turned into a social theory that actually favor the robber barons. You know, we are the best, we are the survivors, So if you apply that to the world, it gets rather nasty. And so Chamberlain amongst a group of American philosophers who accept the findings of modernism, who accept evolution, who accept the findings of the new criticism of the scripture, and yet at the same time are trying to figure out a way to still see the universe as primarily a moral place. Okay, to explain the universe in such a way that you can see it as a moral universe. And in that respect, he's related to his two teachers, Howison and Royce, but also to the larger debate that's going on, not just in the United States, but in the world. Chamberlain's an idealist, and that seems an awfully strange thing if you know anything about Mormon thought. I mean, because, you know, you go back to Orson Pratt, right? And, you know, what's his famous essay? The Absurdities of Immaterialism. And a lot of times, if you think about idealism, you know, that excuse me, that ideal, I just say, that ideals are real, that that's where reality is, and matter is dependent on ideals. It would seem that, you know, Chamberlain would be about as far from being a Mormon thinker as anybody you could imagine. And yet, if you read Chamberlain, you discover that that's not the case. He's quintessentially Mormon. Because what he's proposing is that at the basis of matter is a kind of moral order to the world. And in his early essays, like the one that I just found, before he'd studied with Allison and Royce, he's an out-and-out materialist, but he's trying to work out some kind of panpsychism, kind of like Orson Pratt did. And he writes about Parley and Orson in the essay. But when he goes and studies with Allison and Royce, and later reads the writings of the French philosopher Henri Bergson, he starts to change his mind. And he starts thinking that both realism and materialism is wrong, and idealism is wrong. Now, I'm going to try and explain this by appealing not just to Chamberlain here, but to Bergson, because in the interest of time, I think Bergson does it more simply. Bergson, in a book called Matter and Memory, and Chamberlain taught Bergson at BYU, comes up with an idea he calls the image. And he says, you know, it's wrong. Materialism is wrong in that it does not recognize, and there's long arguments for this, but I'm just going to give you kind of a common sense one. Materialism is wrong in that it does not recognize that we name everything. I mean, you think about matter, matière in French. It's a name. It's a word. Okay. We do not see things in the raw. We don't have immaculate perceptions. Okay, we see things always through our ideas. Okay, so what he says is that what Bergson says, and Chamberlain picks this up, and he says what materialism gets then is this kind of ironic twist into idealism, because it starts saying that these words are the real things. Okay, so that's one side. The other side, he says, no, idealism goes wrong. Because it doesn't see itself as affected by its environment. You know, that there are real things out there. It starts thinking that, you know, all those things are just ideas. If you read Berkeley, for example, or Plato. And so what we get is a kind of two-aspect view. We have to realize that, as William James once said, the path of the human snake is across all things. We have to see that matter is, the way we look at matter, is heavily influenced by ideas, by projections that we project on the world. And at the same time, we have to realize that these ideas come from somewhere. Okay. They are affected by an environment that is real, that's not just ideal. And so in that sense, Chamberlain is an idealist. Now, how is that important for social thought and for attacks on people like Herbert Spencer? Well, I think the answer is kind of obvious, is that there is a whole lot more human projection onto the world than we usually accept. And if that is the case, perhaps the world, if we look at the world as a cutthroat, dog-eat-dog place, perhaps part of that is our projection onto the world. There's a debate about this, well, about the best way to counter this, that takes place in California in 1895. And I'm going to talk about the debate for just a minute, because I'm going to refer to Chamberlain's two teachers, Josiah Royce and George Holmes Allison. And to do that, I'm going to have to give you a little background on each one of them. Allison is from the East, from Massachusetts. Grows up in Ohio. He's from Ohio. He ends up in Massachusetts for a while. Grows up in Ohio, gets a job at University of Washington in St. Louis. And there Chamberlain and Allison are kind of alike in a lot of ways. Allison is teaching mathematics. And he runs into a group of guys who call themselves the Kant Group, okay, the Comp Club. And basically, these are a bunch of guys. One of them is William Torrey Harris, who eventually becomes U.S. Commissioner of Education, but he's out there teaching shorthand, young man, and he's a materialist. At the time, and he's giving a lecture on materialism, and as he's going up to his apartment, he feels this heavy hand on his back, and it's this guy, William Brockmeyer, who's a German immigrant, and he's about as big as Arnold Schwarzenegger. And he also becomes Lieutenant Governor of Missouri, so there, you know, all sorts of strange connections here. And he says something like, "You make bad talk. Let's go talk about this." And he introduces Harris to Hegel. Harris will eventually write a famous commentary on Hegel's logic. And these guys form this little club. And they sit around and they read Brockmeyer's translation of Hegel's Science of Logic. Now, I don't know if any of you have read this. This is not an exciting book. It's 700 pages long of, you know, German philosophy. Okay. Anyway, Brockmeyer is sitting at home. He works at a brick foundry and sits at home with his dog out in the woods playing Thoreau, you know, translating Hegel's Science of Logic. And then these guys get together and they listen to this, you know, and then they give papers to each other. And this becomes the Journal of Speculative Philosophy, which is one of the most important, still in, today, one of the most important American philosophical journals. Anyway, Howison, eventually the group breaks up and they wander off in all sorts of places. Howison quits his job at St. Louis University because he wants to do philosophy. Heads up to Boston, because that's where philosophy goes on in the United States. And there he becomes enamored. There he meets William James. He gets a job as a philosopher at MIT, which about that time was like a community college. He loses the job because of budget cuts. He even hires himself out as a philosophical tutor. Nobody hired him. I could go on with these stories for a long time, and I shouldn't because I actually have to give you a paper here. But to cut a long story short, he goes up for a job at Harvard, but the job's given to this young guy from California, grew up in Grass Valley, California, a guy named Josiah Royce, much younger than him. And so he wanders around for a few more years, gets his job at Berkeley. Okay? It's two sides of the country. And he starts this group there called the Philosophical Union, kind of like the Kant Club in St. Louis. They read somebody's book every year, and then they bribe them in, and they have this big debate. They have William James, and they have all these guys. But in 1895, he brings Royce, and they're going to fight it out. Okay, so it was called the greatest philosophical, by the New York Times and New York Tribune, it was called the greatest philosophical debate in American history. It's kind of hyperbole, they debated the conception of God. And the whole thing is it's an attempt to develop a kind of socially responsible idea of God. In opposition to both really conservative reaction to theories of evolution and higher criticism and to social Darwinism. Now, I'm going to make this a very short what goes on in the debate, but it really is influential on Chamberlain. Royce gives an argument in the conception of God debate of an argument for God from the experience of human ignorance. And basically it goes like this, okay? And I expect you all to be convinced believers once I'm done, which will be in about 30 seconds. Okay. This is actually a really great argument, you know, if you to read it for a long time and you know, if you read anything for a long time, you become convinced. And he spent his whole life with this thing. Royce had already introduced this argument, the religious aspects of philosophy. Central chapter of the book dealt with the possibility of error. Basically, the argument proceeds like this. Since error is possible, two questions arise. What is the truth that makes error possible? And what is the nature of reality which this truth implies? Either there can be no error, or as Royce thought, there is an infinite unity of consciousness, of conscious thought, to whom is present all possible truth. Error is incomplete thought, that viewed from a higher ground, it fails to describe adequately what it was intended to describe. Once you admit that error only exists relative to a higher and more comprehensive thought, there is no stopping place short of an infinite thought. This all reality must pretend to the unity, thus all reality must pretend to the unity of infinite thought, which is God. I can see the conversion happen. Okay. Well, we could spend a long time discussing the intricacies of this argument. I've given you, I'm sure hardly anybody was convinced right then, but basically, you get this idea that the error is only possible because of a higher truth, and because there's a higher truth, there has to be some kind of totality of truth, and that totality of truth we call God. Howison got up, and I think wins the argument with Royce. Basically, he says, Royce really proves, according to Howison, was that the individual thinker, upon reflection, must unavoidably affirm his or her own already all-conditioning reality in and over the field of possible experience. So in other words, what basically Royce has really proven is we all think we're right. Okay? And that's unavoidable, even if we pretend to be humble and say, well, that's my point of view, that's your point of view. You're really saying in the background, you should be tolerant. Okay. And so, Howison's point doesn't stop there, though, of course. He goes on and he says, well, Royce, I really appreciate what Royce is doing, but what he doesn't recognize is he's choosing believing in God, not for metaphysical reasons that he thinks he is, but for moral reasons. Because it's better to believe that there is a meaning to the universe than to believe that there isn't one. This is, if you read William James' essay, Will to Believe, it sounds a lot like what Howison's saying in the Conception of God debate. If we don't have overwhelming proof that we shouldn't believe in a meaning to the universe, we certainly ought to go with our moral intuitions that there is one. Okay, because, it's a better world that way. So there's a kind of, and I'm going to skip out of a lot, over a lot here, but there's a kind of existentialism here that, and I don't think Howison ever quite gets this, recognizes this in his thought, but that this is ultimately a choice about what you think reality is. But at the basis of that choice is something called personalism. And this is what Chamberlain will become. It's what Howison is. It's what Martin Luther King was, a personalist. This was a tradition of philosophy in America, in California, and at Boston University. King did his PhD at Boston University with the Boston personalist. But it's the belief that persons are the ultimate metaphysical category, the ultimate reality of things, and that freedom is at the basis of personal existence. So if you think of that in Howison, you get an idea that we make a choice about whether we think the universe works or not. Okay, and that's a personal choice. Howison sets up a whole philosophy based on this, which is if I had time to lay it out for you, you could see why Chamberlain chose to go to California in 1906. Because Howison gives us a 10-point program basically talking about a divine democracy in which God is, the title of one of his essays is, I can't think of it right now, the divine democracy with the true God at its head, something like that. And what he means by that is that God is intimately related with other creatures in the world who choose to be like him. Now, let me pass from that to our friend William Chamberlain. And let's see, how much time do I have? 5 minutes?
Like 10.
I'll need 10. Okay. Actually, I need about 30. But 10 will do. Okay. Let me skip ahead a little bit. Pardon? Okay. Basically, I guess I will read this. When Chamberlain chose to study with Howison at Berkeley in 1906, he must have known that Howison's personal idealism would not be unsympathetic to his Mormon faith. In his major work, The Limits of Evolution, Howison gave a systematic statement of his position that persons were co-eternal with God, which is similar to the basic Mormon doctrine of the eternal relation between persons and God. This is the position of Chamberlain's 1906 MA thesis, The Unity of Thought is the Society of Minds. If you remember, Royce had claimed the unity of thought is found in God. Here it's the Society of Minds, the title of which seems to refer directly to one of Royce's claims in the Conception of God debate, that all reality must be pretend to the unity of the infinite thought. Chamberlain Howisonized Royce's claim by saying that the unity of thought is to be found in the Society of Minds. He carries this position on with him through his studies with Howison at Royce at Harvard, which is evident from Royce's comments on Chamberlain's papers, The Conception of God, The Highest Good, and The Nature of Truth. Chamberlain writes in his biography that Professor Royce, according to the notes preserved in these papers, was much impressed by the pluralism or social ethical idealism clearly and beautifully stated as a doctrine. It is apparent also in his published pamphlets, his essay on nature published in 1915 toward the end of his time at BYU. Here it is coupled with obvious allusions to Doctrine and Covenants section 130 verses 1 and 2 and his discussion of reality dependent on the sociality of intelligences which will eventually be perfected. I believe that Chamberlain's year with Royce, though, also convinced him of the Kantian limits of Howison's ethical idealism. In this respect, Chamberlain's philosophy is more concrete and personalistic than Howison's. In Howison's philosophy, it ends up sort of being like Orson Pratt. We end up worshiping the moral law. Howison saw the problem of Royce's position, but opposed it with a position that was too formal in the Kantian sense. For Howison, we are ultimately loyal to a moral logic rather than to the other person. Whereas for Chamberlain, loyalty is above all to another person. The prime example of the personal is God. Chamberlain's spiritual realism, is what he called this, is based on the proposition that persons are the ultimate ontological unity. A person is a self-organizing unity or principle whose activity results in a progressive expansion and complication of life. Persons are eternal. They are ontologically and metaphysically ultimate. This personalism is tied to a pragmatic theory of truth, in which truth is determined in relation to the interests and purposes of persons. All of reality evolves out of the interaction and development of persons. Chamberlain thought that his spiritual idealism was, in fact, the most concrete of all philosophical positions. All abstractions, like our notion of matter, require the interaction of persons. They have no meaning by themselves. For example, the concrete experience of person is more fundamental than the abstract notions of either brains or minds, whether you're a materialist or an idealist. Persons presuppose the brains, and not the brains, the persons. We often turn concrete experience around and take it to be take the abstract explanation for the concrete existence. I remember teaching a philosophy class once to freshmen, and a student coming up and said, "I like concrete things, like geometry." Now, the concrete is much more confusing than the abstract. Okay, it's much more rich. We should not take the concrete reality as dependent on the abstract one simply because the abstraction is more simple than the concrete reality we experience. We cannot give an account of this world without some acknowledgement of the spiritual and mental reality. Chamberlain explains that we live in language, and any attempt to explain experience is shot through with these kind of mental constructs. I'm going to skip way ahead. Okay. I'm going to try and get through this section on his LDS view of God. Sociality is an essential feature of the being of persons. You can only be a person in relation to other persons. You know, even Robinson Crusoe is a person because he speaks a language, because he remembers what it was to be like to be with other persons. The moral meaning of the world grows out of the relation of eternal and eternal codependence. That sounds bad, doesn't it? Of persons in community. At the head of this community is God. Unlike Nietzsche, Chamberlain, a personalist, is not reeling to historicize or relativize morality in the same way he has relativized and historicized theoretical truth. In fact, like his teachers Howison and Royce, Chamberlain sought to ground metaphysics and epistemology in an ethical and eschatological vision of an eternal community. Thus, the idea of eternally existing free persons presupposes the relation between them and a view of reality based on these relations as its most basic level. It's a moral view. The universe is necessarily moral. The moral meaning of life is what remains eternal. The moral meaning is tied to the community of intelligences. Now, I'm actually going to quote him. The whole world of persons seems to permit no greater values, and those are embodied in moral and religious interests, the religious being but the moral extended to embrace the greatest person of all, even God. Moral and religious interests grow out of the organic and the prudential. The latter are tested first and are trusted as the most concrete and practical. All other objects in time vanish, and interests supporting them must fail unless they can also support the interests of others. And so, interest in others, moral and religious interests, are truly concrete and practical. Let me go on with another quote from Chamberlain. Nature, then, is a vast social organism. The experience of each one is a sample of the intelligence, beings with the power to do, to know, to feel, who constitute nature. These intelligences differ among themselves in this power as the sun and the stars differ from one another in brightness. These intelligences coexist so that one who is in every way superior to the others, notwithstanding his superiority, was not in existence before the others, each and all of them being ultimate and eternal. Love is created. It can only exist between persons. Okay, this is me again, not Chamberlain. Between persons and not without them. Personality is created only in relation to others. They are presupposed in the very idea of a person. Our existence as persons always presupposes a community of persons. Chamberlain thinks that God is experienceable and in this sense knowable, but not in the sense that I understand concepts. Just as persons can be experienced well in their dynamic character, they cannot be finally reduced to concepts. Similarly, God cannot be reduced to a concept. Chamberlain describes this experienced relation to others and God in the following terms. One last quote from Chamberlain, then I'll wrap up. The ultimate reality is unknowable only in the sense that one of our ideas or attitudes while experiencing itself in living cannot be known by another attitude save in the external and picture process. The latter effort or attitude does not deny the former, but presupposes it. Of the relationships of persons to each other and to our Father, we are immediately aware. We are inextricably knit to one another and to God our Father. Now, the last part of this paper, which I won't read, describes God as the ultimate example of a person. And basically, it's a moral vision of God as being one, the ideal member of a community. God as having the interests of others most intimately bound up in God's very being. And so we get in Howison and in Chamberlain, and also in Royce, in his idea of the philosophy of loyalty and the heavenly community, a notion of reality as existing because of the interaction between persons. And from a Mormon point of view, this would be because of the interactions between intelligences. And I'm going to leave it at that. There's about 10 more pages. But I could read one word on each page, and then maybe that would work. Okay. Thank you.
I'm going to turn it over to Rex.
I was excited when I saw Jim's entry in this year's program. I did not and do not know Chamberlain nearly so well as Jim, but I knew enough at least to entertain the suspicion that he deserved more attention than he's received. Jim's paper has gone some way toward remedying my ignorance and hardening my suspicion into full-fledged belief, and it deserves a better response, more narrowly tailored to its contents than what I'm about to give. Unfortunately, I do not have one to offer, although what I am about to say has the virtue of brevity. In any event, I hope there might be some value in reflecting on the nature of Jim's paper. One of my favorite contemporary philosophers, Jay Rosenberg, characterizes philosophy as, quote, a discipline without data. What philosophy has in place of data is a history, end quote. I'm not entirely sure I agree, but I find it a constructively provocative thesis, according to which understanding Chamberlain is placing him, Chamberlain, for example, is placing him in the context of an ongoing conversation. Thus, Jim has elucidated Chamberlain's thought by locating it in the context of a conversation participated in by Chamberlain, his teachers, and successors in a line including Martin Luther King and reaching down to Jim himself. In doing so, Jim has considered Chamberlain primarily as a philosopher in the personalist tradition. But what about Chamberlain as a Mormon philosopher? Did Chamberlain relate his positions to those of other Mormon philosophers? Did others relate their ideas to his? Separate and apart from whether and how Chamberlain related his ideas to his predecessors and contemporaries, how does Jim think Chamberlain's ideas relate to those of other Mormon philosophers? Jim mentioned Orson Pratt. Pratt advocated a kind of atomistic animism, according to which the universe is ultimately composed of intelligent material atoms. This seems to be, in some respects, similar, and in other respects, dissimilar to the personalist theory that persons are the metaphysical ultimates. So how do Chamberlain and Pratt relate? Jim made a couple of comments in this direction, but that is an example of a question about which I would like to hear more. This is not a criticism of Jim's paper. It's not to say that he should have written a different paper. Rather, it's to say that however many he's written so far, I hope he goes on to write still one more. I see the question I've asked about Chamberlain's relation to other Mormon philosophers as part and parcel of a larger enterprise, and that is identifying or developing the conversational thread or threads that define a Mormon philosophical tradition. Jim's paper exemplifies one important exercise for Mormon philosophy, identifying and exploring sympathetic themes and developments in Mormon doctrine on the one hand and philosophical schools of thought on the other. That exercise is essentially outward-looking. But I think that developing and sustaining a vibrant tradition of Mormon philosophy requires that we also foster an inward-looking aspect. We must pay more attention to the interactions and interrelations of the work already done by Mormon philosophers, and we should more conscientiously frame our own contributions in terms responsive to them. Otherwise, what we have is a roadmap of intersections between philosophical traditions and the Mormon experience, but no identifiable tradition of Mormon philosophy.
Well, he wasn't kidding. That was 3-4 minutes. Since we do have some time for questions, and since a little bit more time, I'll have one first, and then I'll get to that gentleman. Just amplifying Rex's remarks, this is a question that's been posed many times about what can be said about Mormon theology insofar as it can even be properly construed as containing a philosophical tradition. It seems like, given the hierarchical nature of the church, what you really have is broad-based speculation from various authorities that really don't seem to have any discernible philosophical thread, and then outliers like Chamberlain who have unsponsored work. It doesn't really catch hold except with maybe a few Mormons, and is of such a conceptuality that it doesn't even seem clear to most Mormons what it has to do with what general authorities talk about in their somewhat philosophical speculative work. So my question is, to what extent should we even, you know, hold W.H. Chamberlain as being part of a Mormon philosophical tradition, if that is even a coherent way of picturing a philosophy or characterizing philosophy in Mormon intellectual history? And if he can be considered as contributing to that, what do you think the special merit of his philosophy is? And then we'll get there.
Okay, I'm going to kind of try and respond both to Rex and to John's questions. First to Rex, because I think both day before yesterday, I spent yesterday moving my son to another apartment in BYU. But yesterday I spent the day at the church archives reading an essay that I didn't know existed called Man, His Origin and Destiny. about Chamberlain. It's a paper that doesn't appeal to any philosophers outside the Mormon tradition. It talks about Parley P. Pratt, The Key to Science of Theology. It talks about the lectures of on faith and talks about Doctrine and Covenants and the Book of Mormon. And it's a really interesting piece. He is more of a materialist in it. I think it's before he went off to graduate school. But it does show to me how his basic idea is the same at the end as it was at the beginning. He talks about, matter of fact,
now bear with me for 1 second.
I wrote it down.
Let me just read to you the conclusion.
I'm sorry about this, but it just seemed like the thing to do at the time. Okay. As we now have a spiritual body corresponding to our temporal body, DNC 9333, so we shall have a spiritual body corresponding to our universal tabernacle. Even the Holy Spirit extending throughout all extent and thought, that we may become aware of all things and have power to direct and control all things in accordance with our laws, necessarily laid down by a greater in order to obey, to bring about this happy state to all His obedient children, DNC 88, 34, and 35. Then it can truly be said that we are in the Father and the Father is in us, and that the Father and we are one, DNC 93.3, not in thought alone, but in tabernacle also. This is our view of the destiny of man, that the working out of that destiny is the learning to subject ourselves to the law. To law is, I trust, made clear. Humble obedience to the will of the perfect is the necessary and sole condition to our becoming perfect as He is perfect. The point there is, what he comes up with is the idea that, if you look at DNC 88, that you have a sense when it's talking about Christ being in and above and all through all things, that the universe, in a way, becomes the body of Christ. And that as we become perfect, we become a part of that body, both one with Christ and yet separate from Him. It's an interesting little essay, you know, and like I say, he's read this before he's really got into all this strange Roycean idealism and stuff. He's written this down. He's gotten it from Parley Pratt and from the Scriptures. Now, when he comes back and starts writing in a perhaps more wider philosophical audience, and we only have those writings because those were the writings that he used for his classes. I think, you know, these Mormon ideas are in really behind everything that he does. It's kind of like a lot of us who go to graduate school start casting around for philosophers so we can get through graduate school who we then Mormonize. Kind of like if you read this Sugar Beat recently, there was a little article in there saying that C.S. Lewis had been made an honorary general authority. Okay. Anyway, one last comment about doing philosophy in a Mormon setting. I think, you know, I've said this morning, that religion precedes philosophy. Our theology. We believe something and then we try and make sense of it. We experience something and then we try and make sense of it. And in that sense, though, of doing theology in Mormonism is very, very important, at least for some of us. Maybe not for everybody, but for some of us, because it becomes a religious activity. It becomes a way that we remain Mormon or remain believers, because we have to make sense of it. Not everybody needs that, but some do.
And then the gentleman there, you want to come up so you can wrap your up?
Just two quick observations to add. John's observation that GA's just sort of, the pronouncements are made, they tend to be rather broad, nonspecific, and they certainly aren't by name responsive to anyone in particular. But consider, for example, the fact that Joseph F. Smith had this paper in his papers. To me, that brought to mind the paper that his presidency issued on the nature. I think his presidency did one on the nature of the Godhead. Am I correct in that? And so I think that the if you're talking about what the general authorities are saying in particular, while they're not responding to people by name, they are responding to people, and I think that is of itself an interesting and important exercise, is developing those interconnections so that, again, we can see, so that we can begin to discern an identifiable Mormon philosophy tradition, whether the general authorities are actively and avowedly participating in that or not. There may be one there to be constructed. And I'd be interested to see, that's first comment. Second comment, I'd be interested to see the Pratt piece, the Chamberlain piece talking about the Pratts, because I think one thing that Jim made reference to, Mormons making it through graduate school by finding some philosopher and Mormonizing him, I think that is a very common course, and I think that's part of what I was characterizing as an outward-looking approach. And I think what we end up with is a bunch of disparate connections, and I think apart from trying to draw in figures outside of the Mormon philosophy tradition, we should all, including Chamberlain, people should have done more. Well, no point in arguing about what people should have done. What we should certainly, one ideal that we should have for ourselves is to do a better job of tying into the work that other people have done before. So,
anyone else? One at a time.
My question and interest on Chamberlain is, what were his views on evolution and natural selection in Darwin's work, and did he make any integrations with that, with some of that, with his philosophy and, well, with Mormonism, basically? And I just hear some comments on that, because that interests me very much.
Okay, yeah, he, in an article I wrote in Dialogue about 6 years ago, there's a section on Chamberlain on evolution. Matter of fact, when the thing happened at... Chamberlain was a real idealist. He didn't live in the world. When the thing happened at BYU, he wrote an essay in the White and the Blue, the BYU newspaper, called "The Theory of Evolution as an Aid to Faith and Belief in the Resurrection." Okay, he thought that would solve everything, and I sent that one to President Smith, too. and President Smith, it's in the papers, and President Smith's marks are in it from reading the essay. And in that essay, he writes that he thinks evolution is a basic principle of the universe. Bergson does. He's not a neo-Darwinian. It's a teleological evolution. He views this this is the way he takes evolution and higher criticism of the scripture and actually puts them together. He thinks God is trying to introduce attitude, well, trying first to create beings capable of thinking. It takes a long time if you actually believe in freedom. And then once those beings become capable of freedom, of bringing them along, trying to create what he calls attitudes in them, that will make possible, that will move beyond simply survival, to make possible this point where you get to be interested in the interests of others. He takes Christ as the primary example of this. And the reason that he ends the essay on evolution and saying why evolution is actually something arguing for the resurrection is that God wouldn't have taken all this time to create beings who could finally communicate with him and then just let him die. Maybe that's not a strong argument, but it's a nice one. Okay, but yeah, he regarded evolution as a just a basic principle of reality.
Did that get him into a lot of trouble and alienation then?
It did with some of the folks down there. Yeah. What the irony is, and I've got an article that hopefully will be coming out in BYU Studies next year sometime. On this, the irony is, the people, President Brimhall, Horace Cummings, who disagreed with the Chamberlains and the Petersons, did so for the same reason that Bryan was against evolution. Not just that, you know, I want to believe in the literal Bible. It was that, no, you know, morality should mean something. And this is the irony of the thing, because that's exactly what Chamberlain's trying to prove. And so you have this, you know, you've all seen Cool Hand Luke. What we have here is a failure to communicate. Anyone else?
You got 5 more minutes.
About the atonement.
Question is, what did Chamberlain have to say about the atonement?
I'm sure he did. Question is whether I can think of it right now. Well, he writes about Christ, and he writes about Christ in fairly traditional ways. You know, as for him, Christ and the crucifixion are primarily exemplary. Okay, so the atonement, what Christ shows us is a life that is completely for the other. And that in itself is the atonement. You know, and so the death of Christ is, you know, kind of the ultimate fulfillment of that kind of life. So I think what Chamberlain comes up with is an exemplary theory of atonement, because Christ has shown us how to live. And how to live is—it's not just to be a Boy Scout; it's to actually be totally concerned with the other, totally absorbed in relation to the other. And he writes really rather eloquently again about this. What's wonderful about reading Chamberlain's essays is they're kind of boring at first. He starts talking about all this attitude stuff, and you know, and it's fairly dry. And then the last 3 pages, it's like he gets revved up. And he starts to like preach, and that's what he starts talking about: is this the divine community, and Christ is the example of what it is to live in the divine community, and this is why he actually thinks he believes in something like the virgin birth. He says that, you know, this, God had to do something special to create a being like this who would live like this and show us how to be. One thing Chamberlain also says, though, in one of his essays in The White and the Blue at BYU is kind of interesting, because he has this kind of narrative sense of the world. He's talking about the pioneers, and he says, you know, Mormonism is so great. You know, it's such a wonderful history. And he goes, even if it wasn't true, there's no reason why we can't make it true. I think that's a great line. Okay. But it goes into what he's saying about personalism, too. Is that part of what truth is isn't just a fact that's out there that you passively confront. It's something you actually have to get out and do. And that's what Christ showed us.
I think we all clap now, unless you have a question.
I did have a question to consider his idea of God as a community of persons with a father and mother at its head. I didn't
get to that. No.
You didn't get to the mother part.
Yeah, there's at the end of that essay in go to the mic. Okay.
You got one.
We want the mother in heaven on tape.
Okay, the mother in heaven's going to be on tape. at the end of the essay, the theory of evolution as an aid to faith and belief in the resurrection. Long title. He starts talking, and this is the only place where he mentions the mother in heaven, but he starts talking about the resurrection, and he starts talking about being worthy to live with God the Father, with Christ, with the Adamic being, you know, reference to Brigham Young, and with our mother. And that's it. That's what he says. But that's pretty interesting. Yeah, back there.
You just finished and tell us what happened to Mr.
Chamberlain. He died of pneumonia. Of the flu. Yeah, he was at BYU, and then he went back to he resigned from BYU under pressure, went back to Harvard, studied at Harvard for a year with Perry, didn't finish his dissertation, came back to Utah, taught extension classes at the University of Utah, went back up to Logan, taught at BY College in Logan, then got an offer to go back to BYU and teach at the summer school there, but he got the flu and died in the flu epidemics of the early 20s. And then, you know, was kind of rehabilitated, you know, about the Soviets, these do this, but kind of rehabilitated in the later, in the mid-20s when his brother Ralph wrote his biography, and there's this wonderful letter from President McKay apologizing for the church, for what happened to William Chamberlain, which is, President McKay was just a great guy. Okay.
Thanks for coming, everybody.